And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We stream live at KUCI.org. We podcast on iTunes. You can go there, subscribe to Writers on Writing, and when we podcast this show, which should be next week, it will arrive in your inbox, your podcast inbox, and you can listen again. Today is Wednesday, August 8th, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are memoirists Liz Scott and Sands Hall. First up is Liz Scott. Liz has been a psychologist in private practice for more than 40 years. Her short stories have appeared in numerous literary journals, including Lake Effect, Pointed Circle, Listening Eye, Literary Mama, and Voice Catcher. She won first place in a sudden fiction contest with the Berkeley Fiction Review, served two terms on the board of Oregon Literary Arts. Originally from New York City, Liz Scott lives and works in Portland, Oregon, and she's here today to talk about her memoir, This Never Happened, published by University of Hell Press. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. So great to have you. I first became aware of your memoir. I don't know if it was on LitHub. It was somewhere you published an essay about why memoirs matter.
Right. I think that was in The Millions.
The Millions. That's it.
Yes.
Talk about that, and then maybe we could segue into how your memoir came about.
I have found I love the form of memoir, and have always found it so reassuring, and the power of a memoir to make us feel heard and seen and actually not alone. I think it's such a powerful form.
So then your memoir, it's interesting. I like memoirs, that take different forms, but yours seems to be comprised of vignettes that aren't necessarily chronological. It's not a chronological memoir with three acts, but is composed of vignettes. And I really like this form because it does, to me, it fits the idea of memoir, right? I mean, things don't necessarily happen in a straight line in a writer's life. They can be really hard to sell, I think. Talk about that and connecting with University of Hell Press.
Yeah, well, I agree with you about the way memory works, actually, is that it's not chronological. And I also don't have a very good memory. So when I was writing this, I would write these different vignettes. And what I tried to do is, instead of creating kind of a continuous story arc, is create an emotional arc in the story, in the narrative, which I hope I did. And so I knew this wasn't going to be a book that maybe one of the major houses was going to love, kind of genre bending in that way. So I only wanted to be with a small press, and I think small presses are awesome anyway. I think they're great. And so I sent out queries and sort of cold called a number of small presses, and I got this response from UHEL Press, and they were wonderfully supportive and actually loved my book, which I was happy about. And I had a wonderful editor there, and it was a wonderful experience. It was a great experience.
Yeah, I never heard of this press before your book.
Mm-hmm.
And I too love indie presses, and find sometimes that they are maybe a little more, pay a little bit more attention to marketing and supporting their authors. I think I contacted them and about you, they got right back to me and sent me a book. And I mean, it was a very cool interaction with them.
Yeah, they're wonderfully supportive. It's a very personal experience, and I have friends who have published in bigger houses that don't quite have that same personal interaction, and so I couldn't be happier. They were great, and they are willing to take a chance on more, I think they call it incendiary works, and more provocative works, and I think that's fantastic. I think the world needs more of that.
So, yeah, and your memoir is a little different. It has photographs, it has maps, it has letters. So maybe talk a little bit about that, about, you know, how these different pieces came to be a part of the book.
Right. So a big part of my motivation in writing this was to try to find some answers to the many, many secrets and mysteries of my family. And so I sort of, as I explain, I sort of went on this, like, an archaeological dig, trying to find some of the, I don't know, unanswered questions that neither of my parents were willing to reveal. And so I found letters, I found pictures, and they all sort of came together in the patchwork of what I was able to come up with, which in the end was not that much in terms of answers. Ultimately, I had to make peace with all the unanswered questions this family left me with. But those felt like major pieces in the puzzle, so I was able to construct at least some parts of this jigsaw puzzle using pictures and letters.
So when you approached the press, did you approach them with a finished manuscript with the letters and the pictures and the maps and all of that, or did you submit a book proposal, or how did that go?
I submitted the full manuscript.
And then did they have any qualms about all the extra non-written aspects of the book?
They had zero qualms about
it. That's great.
It was fantastic. I mean, you know, like I said, I had a wonderful editor, and we were really simpatico. And I think part of the, as I say, sort of genre bending aspects of the book is part of what was appealing to them.
That's great.
Yeah.
Did you have to leave anything out, or do you wish now that the book has been published that there's something you wish you had included?
I didn't have to leave anything out. There's one photograph I wish I'd included. And of course, I've done a lot of readings, and at every reading I think, oh, I could have said that sentence maybe a little bit better. there are probably edits like that I would make, but there was only one photograph I wish I'd included.
What was that?
There was, you know, I talk in the book about the importance of my childhood best friend who lived across the street from me. We met on the first day of kindergarten and were like one melded unit from that time until we graduated from high school. And we really grew each other up. We both came from very dysfunctional families, and we were each other's salvation. And I write a lot about her in the book. And later, after it was published, she sent me a picture of the two of us when we were about kindergarten age, sitting in a field together, obviously very close and warmly related to each other. So I wish I'd been able to include that photo.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Liz Scott. Her memoir is This Never Happened, published by University of Hell Press. Do you recommend your clients write?
I love journaling. I think it's amazing. I think there's something magic that happens, especially pen to paper, not on computer, where you kind of short-circuit the resistance and kind of can tap into your unconscious a little bit more. And it's like you can find yourself saying, wow, I didn't realize I felt that way. So I think it's an amazing tool, not only for that, but because if you are somebody that keeps a journal with some regularity, you can see the progress you've made more easily, where a lot of this kind of emotional, psychological work is rock chipping. It's hard to see progress in the moment. So if you can read back what you wrote a month, 3 months, 6 months ago, it's easier to say, wow, that's not how I feel anymore. So I think it's an amazing experience. I think this is another, I might have written this in the Millions essay too, that I don't think it's a great idea to write a memoir as a therapeutic undertaking. I think you need to have a little bit more narrative distance, and the material has to be more well digested before you can set out to write an actual piece of, you know, memoir or something like that, or a piece of fiction even. Otherwise, it does sound more like a journal or a diary entry. But I think writing as a process in and of itself can be extremely therapeutic.
Do you ever deal with creatives with writer's block issues or creativity issues?
Not so much directly, but a lot of my work is about what keeps us stuck in general, whether it's in an artistic process or in relationships or at work, whatever. So I think there's some kind of universals about that, getting at what is getting in the way, what's keeping us stuck.
You know, I wanted to talk about the title, too. This Never Happened. I love that title. I think that, as well as your essay in the Millions, really appealed to me. At what point did the title come about?
I'm glad you liked the title. So it is the title of one of the chapters. And titles are so hard, you know, they're really challenging. And I guess the reason I landed on that title is a couple of things. First of all, again, I have very few actual concrete memories of my childhood. So there is this kind of sense of unreality almost. And then the fact, the particular facts of my family, where we were completely cut off. We never met any relatives, not a cousin, not a grandparent, not an aunt or an uncle. We were completely cut off. And so there was a sense that we were kind of plopped down on earth, you know, unattached to anything. So this never happened seemed to be resonant with that experience, too. It seemed to just kind of fit my sense. Like, did this family ever come from anywhere? Mm-hmm. You know? So it just, it seemed accurate to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. I don't see this at all as a prescriptive nonfiction or self-help memoir, but on page 243, you start a chapter called Some Issues That Are Hard for a Child of Narcissists to Sort Out. And that is so interesting. And I'm thinking, are we all children of narcissists? You know, I mean, oh, my gosh.
It's endemic these days. You know, it's really, I think there's a sort of cultural inclination towards narcissism because this, our country is so individual focused, you know, not like the kind of collectivist societies like Japan. And so I think there's a, you know, we're prone. And of course, narcissism with a small n, you know, is one thing. With a capital N is a whole other thing. There's a continuum there.
Talk about that. What do you mean?
Well, you know, you can look at somebody that you would consider self-centered and always wanting to talk about themselves and that kind of thing. And they're probably more narcissistic with a small N. You can use that as an adjective. But somebody that has narcissistic personality disorder, that's a whole different thing. You're talking about somebody who really has a hollow core and that the people in their life exist really only as a way that kind of services their sense of self, that is a way that they can, that reflects upon them. And so it's they believe that they're special and unique and that they require excessive admiration, real strong sense of entitlement. They lack empathy to a pretty significant degree. So these are diagnostic criteria that you might find very different than somebody who's simply very a self-centered person or conceited,
sure,
as you might say.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to have to read this chapter again.
But it's a continuum. Again, it's a continuum, and it can be very challenging to be in any kind of relationship with anybody that even has narcissistic traits.
So true. It's sort of, those tend to be a walking on eggshell type of relationships, don't they?
Exactly. And you end up not feeling seen or like the other person's not really, you're not as significant in the relationship as they are. So it can feel like there's a lot of asymmetry and imbalance in the relationship.
So what about actually the writing of these vignettes, these chapters, and putting it all together? How long did your book take?
Well, I've been thinking about it for decades. There were two problems with starting to write it. First of all, I couldn't get my arms around a structure or how to proceed in that way. And second of all, I really couldn't do this while my parents were alive. And there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, one of the prime reasons is my mother, tragic soul as she was, wanted nothing more in life than to be famous as a writer. And I wanted nothing more to be anything but her. So even thinking about writing just felt like I didn't want to go anywhere near that. It felt too much like being like exactly like her. So I had to differentiate myself psychologically enough to know that that wasn't the case, first of all. And then it felt needlessly unkind to write this while they were alive. And the other thing is, my mother was so challenging to spend time with, so challenging to be in relationship with, even on a telephone call, that I didn't kind of have the emotional space, the kind of distance to be able to look at this in a more dispassionate way, which I think was necessary to do. Like I said earlier, I think it's important to have this material more digested.
Mm-hmm.
So she died in 2005, and I started really thinking about it in earnest, and then I had the issue of trying to figure out a form, and that was very confusing, so I would go for months without even thinking about it. And then I read a memoir by Nick Flynn, who's mostly a poet, and mm-hmm. he has this kind of nonlinear form in his book, and the same sort of jumping around, even different points of view, and that really freed me up. So I think I started writing it maybe 5 years ago in earnest, and I'm somebody that has pretty short attention span, so I would write these individual chapters, and then the challenge was, how do I string them together? How do I put them together? And I think there are 75 or so chapters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did was just put the chapter title on index cards, and I put those index cards on my living room floor and kept shifting them, moving them around over and over and over again until I found an order that seemed right.
Mm. And then revisions. How many
mm-hmm.
revisions?
I love revisions. I love it. Staring at a blank page is horrifying.
Yes.
But to me, and I have a really hard time with that, but revisions I love. I love, I love, I love. I mean, and I probably, like a lot of writers, I write out loud. So I would just read what I wrote out loud, and it was easier for me then to figure out a better way to say it. And I was constantly pushing myself to be brave, and to not hold back, and to, you know, caution be damned. And that's what how I would approach revising each piece.
And then the time between University of Hell Press accepting the manuscript and then the book hitting the bookstores.
Right. So my editor and I worked on edits together for maybe 4 months, I would say. And then, you know, they had to send it to layout, and we had to do cover design. Just a P.S., that my cover is designed by a woman that's in my writing group, and so she knew my book intimately, so that was a lot of fun, but we went through a lot of iterations on that. That whole process probably took a good year before it went to press.
See, that's another great thing about indie presses. The book gets out sooner. It seems like most of the time the book gets out sooner as opposed to maybe 18 months, which isn't
I think that's true.
That much longer, but it's long enough.
It's long enough. It's long enough, and it feels like forever. Even that year time felt like forever.
But isn't that fun, that editing process, working with the editor and seeing the notes and revising and getting it back to the editor?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved it. And I love my editor so much. And it was a great experience. I adore that part of it. I could do that endlessly.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that's just the great, great fun.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice for the memoirists out there who are listening.
Be brave. Be brave. Say your truth. It's going to be different than what the other people in your family have to say, probably. Some people might not like it. You know, be as vulnerable as you can let yourself be. That's where I think the power in connecting is when we see somebody else's vulnerability.
Thank you so much, Liz. It's been
Thank
a pleasure.
Thank you, Barbara.
That was Liz Scott. Her memoir is This Never Happened, published by University of Hill Press. Stay tuned. We will be back momentarily with Sands Hall. Her memoir is called Flunk, Start, Reclaiming My Decade Lost in Scientology, published by Counterpoint. I love Counterpoint. What else can I tell you before we go to break? Oh, there's a speaker series coming up on August 20th in Newport Beach. Janet Fitch and Leland De La Durante, who's been on the show, both have been on the show, will be there. You can find out more by visiting penonfire.com and click on speaker series. It's coming up at the Lido Village Bookstore. We're going to take a real short break and then should be back with Sands Hall, so don't go anywhere.
Yes, I'm doing fine. It's been so long now since I've seen you, but it seems like yesterday. Ain't it funny, how time slips right on away. She's doing fine. I heard you told her,
people say you told her,
that you were gonna love her till the end of time. Well, that's the same thing that you told me. I see you somewhere around. I don't know when though. I'll never know when I'm back in town. But please remember
yeah.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine, at UC Irvine, actually. We're streaming live at KUCI.org, and the show, along with hundreds, perhaps thousands of others, will be podcast next week on iTunes and Stitcher, maybe elsewhere. I don't know. Wherever it is online, you can listen to it. If you subscribe to Writers on Writing on iTunes and Stitcher, when it arrives there, you'll receive it in your inbox. Next up is Sands Hall. She wrote Catching Heaven, a Penguin Random House Readers Circle Selection, and a Willa Award finalist for Best Contemporary Fiction, and a book of writing essays and exercises, Tools of the Writer's Craft. Her plays include an adaptation of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women and the comic drama Fair Use, which explores the was it plagiarism controversy surrounding Wallace Stegner's novel Angle of Repose. Sands is also a singer-songwriter and recently produced her first CD, Rustler's Moon, and performs widely. She's also a theater artist. Her directing experience runs the gamut from Shakespeare to Gerardo to new works by new playwrights. She leads workshops and lectures for such conferences as the Community of Writers at Squaw Valley and the Iowa Summer Writing Festival. Sands is currently Associate Teaching Professor of English and Creative Writing at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where she's also the editor of the F&M Alumni Arts Review. She lives in the foothills of California's Sierra Nevada, and she's here today to primarily talk about her new memoir, Flunk, Start, Reclaiming My Decade Lost in Scientology, published by Counterpoint. Hi, Sands.
Hi there, Barbara.
Great to have you on. I was so happy to hear about this book. Would love it if you would begin by telling us how it came about.
Well, one of the things I, and thanks for that lovely introduction, and I just so enjoyed listening to a bit of the interview with Ms. Scott. What a fascinating thing, and we shared so many things in common as she spoke. It was really interesting. Mm. Well, as I say at the very beginning of my memoir, I spent a decade of my life pretending that a decade of my life hadn't happened. I was pretty mortified once I'd finally managed to escape the organization of Scientology, and I just didn't really want to talk about it. It seemed like a terrible squandering of almost a decade of my life. But various things happened, including it's hard to remember that the internet wasn't quite as prevalent in years past as it was, but at one point about maybe 15 years ago, I went online to check and see if a conference I was scheduled to teach for, if my bio had made it up onto the website. And the first thing, when I typed in my name, the first thing that came up was Scientology courses taken by Sands Hall. Hmm. And it meant that, you know, I was outed, so to speak. And I write about this moment in the memoir where there was just this, I kind of slammed down the hit of the lid of the laptop as though that would make a difference. And to not everybody seeing it that went looking, that happened to go looking for me. And then there was sort of this clear moment of like, oh my God, I don't have to pretend anymore, that it is, it's just something. And so I began then to think about what those years had been and why I was running away from looking at them. And of course, I am a writer, so I began to write about it. And little by little, it occurred to me I was actually working on a memoir. So that's how it came about.
How long was that process? When did you start writing about it?
I would say at least 7 years before it was published. I was writing fragments and sorting stuff out. And then I began to realize, when I began to actually be able to say I had been a Scientologist, which was very hard for me, I couldn't actually get those words out for a very long time. And I had this shame, such a profound shame around it. And I loved that people would immediately tell me their shame, and that so many people had years of their lives that they wished they'd done something else with, or that
they were sorry about or ashamed of. And that really solidified in me that my book was more important than just talking about this, you know, why I'd been pulled into this cult, why I stayed as long as I did, that it was really about reclaiming those years and finding a different way to look at them. And I think the thing that's been most gratifying, Barbara, is the number of letters I have received from strangers, not ex-Scientologists, which is what I kind of hoped I'd reach, although, and I have, but the letters that I've received from people saying that the example of reclaiming those years was really, really powerful and allowed them to look at their own, quote-unquote, squandered years in a different way. That's been really profound for me.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I think we've all spent time doing things, however long or short, that we look back on and we go, now, what would I have done differently there? And I think that's
right.
Sort of the universal aspect of the memoir, that even, you know, without being interested in Scientology or how someone dealt with years in it, you know, dealing with years in something.
Correct. That's exactly right. And also coming to terms with the kind of wonderful truth that we wouldn't be where we are doing what we're doing. Well, basically, be who we are without that trek through the underworld. I mean, it's the hero's journey, you know, too. It's like, I am who I am because I did that stupid thing, or I went that silly place, or I spent all those years in that marriage, or I did that. You know, people have got all kinds of stories of their own years they wish they'd spent some other way, but then they are who they are as a result of them. You know.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was in Los Angeles recently, just before I learned of your book, and I drove by the Scientology building, which is this huge, huge building, purple or periwinkle or whatever color it is. And I was so curious. I had no idea there was such a huge compound. And so, you know, I think I said to somebody, the offices must be rented out to independent companies or people. And they said, no, it's all Scientology.
Mm-hmm. It's vast. It's enormous. Yeah.
I mean, how many
even with, I think, all of the very powerful attacks that are, you know, being levered against it. I'm, you know, really impressed by what Leah Remini's up to, and a guy named Tony Ortega on his terrific blog called The Underground Bunker. It's amazing that they still manage to get acolytes. And it's because I think of the promise that they offer. We all are looking for meaning, and that's what I try to present in my... Oh, I'm so sorry. That's what I'm trying to present in my memoir, which is what is it that actually pulls a person to join something like that? What are the very specific elements of one's own life that, because I think it's unique, that would make such a thing be incredibly intriguing, and intriguing enough that in spite of all kinds of warnings and in spite of the strange blue of the building, you would still step towards it and step into it.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And there's so much material coming out lately. I mean, documentaries I'm aware of on Scientology, and yet it continues to attract people. But what do you attribute to, you know, the documentaries and just all the info coming out? It seems like it's a collective unconscious kind of moment where all this material is finding its way.
That's such a great question. It's sort of multi-pronged answer. In some ways, I think that the fact that stuff is coming out, that people are finally feeling empowered to speak, is huge. I mean, just that the recent memoir about the Jehovah's Witnesses as well, that there is something about other people speaking up that makes it feel less scary to speak up, especially around an organization that is known as a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And especially that idea that if you speak negatively about it, if you try to break away, you will be shunned by those still in it. That seems to be a real, you know, dividing line there. And I think that there was a bit of power in numbers in that, that there is, look, I managed to speak up, and yes, the Church of Scientology, I'm not talking about myself right now, but the Church of Scientology threw many things at me and attempted to make me shut up, but they didn't make me shut up. And that gives power to others to speak up. And I think that's true about the Jehovah's Witness. I mean, any group like that where people actually get empowered. And I also think there's something alive in our culture right now, especially, well, let's say in America and in Britain, in Germany and Italy, where there is this authoritarian cultures are beginning to hold sway and seem to be attractive to people, and that Scientology is nothing if not authoritarian. There is a person who speaks, and you do what that person says, and it's all written, and it's all into the guise of spirituality, which can attract a lot of people, but there is a very powerful sense of what you can and cannot do and what is right under the auspices of this, that for some reason is very attractive in the world today to people. And I believe that there are such parallels between, for instance, in my opinion, David Miscavige and Donald Trump, that there are some very interesting aspects to the way that they approach bullying and lying their way through, you know, getting away from stuff that's been said in the news. And we might be called fake news in Scientology. It's called black PR. Hmm. And I think there are parallels that I think are a little scary, mm-hmm. and part mm-hmm. of this effort, which I am so proud to be part of, is to speak up against that and say I will not be terrorized. I talk about this in the book. I had a dream before the book was going to be published, and it was like this weird waking dream, Barbara. I was kind of aware of having it, almost even of creating it. What it was, I was standing upright in a kind of sarcophagus, and there was a stone all around me, and there was this thing that had been lowered in place, a big slab had been lowered in place right above me, and I knew there was no way to press that slab up. It was too heavy, and I knew there was no way to get out of this thing I was in, that I could scratch and I could scream and no one would hear me and I would never get it. It was a terrifying dream. And it was talking about it to a friend that I realized that I kept saying I was shut up. I was shut up. And I realized that I was terrified of bringing my book out because of what the church might do to me. And that I was being told in the dream, in a way, are you going to shut up? And that, it just cemented me in going, no, I'm publishing my book.
I was wondering if you were ever worried about repercussions from the organization or if you were ever shunned.
Well, one of the things I try to do in the book is describe my wonderful group of friends that I had when I was part of the Church of Scientology. We shared our artistic endeavors. We laughed a lot. We had a great time. They were very dear people. And this is part of the trap, is we all felt we were working on something together, and we strengthened each other's decisions to be in part of it. If we ever had any doubt, you know, we would strengthen each other. And when I first left the church, we just dropped out of touch. They couldn't be in touch with me. I knew that, and I didn't even try. And then I detail this in the memoir, but I found out the man I married who'd gotten me into the Church of Scientology had died, and I had just finished the first draft of the memoir, and I decided to go to his memorial service in Los Angeles, and I was teaching back east in Pennsylvania at the time. And it was a very spur-of-the-moment decision. I literally flew out the next morning. And I stayed with a friend who was still a Scientologist, and I was amazed that she welcomed me, but she did. And she had been trying to reach out to me, and we had some talks, and I hung out with that group of people for that day and that evening. Those, and they were largely still in the Church of Scientology. And we were friends. Everything was fine. And we stayed in touch over the next couple of years. And then when they found out that this book was being published, one of that group wrote to me with a CC to the rest of them saying, you know, if you publish this book, you are cutting the line to us down here. Mm. She meant in L.A. Mm-hmm. And I wrote back and said, it won't be me cutting the line, but I know, being good Scientologists, that you will feel you need to. Hmm. And that indeed happened. You know, that was just it. So that's that aspect of the church that, or the cult, whatever. To honor them, I'll call it a church. But that's what's necessary. You cannot doubt. And that was the reason I finally had to leave, is I could not follow where my own curiosity might take me. I mean, imagine not being able to Google anything you wanted to or go into a library and read any book you felt like reading and applying your mind to it.
Yeah.
And that was what was verboten, was applying your own mind to things that might make you doubt.
So interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Sands Hall. Her book is Flunk, Start, Reclaiming My Decade Lost in Scientology. Let's talk about the title. And you had said that the paperback's coming out in November with a different title, a variation on the title.
Yes. When I first came up with this title, it just ties the themes of the book together really powerfully, because the book is not only about my slow involvement in the Church of Scientology. It's about my family. It's about my beloved older brother who suffered a terrible brain injury and perhaps that trauma was very much what sort of sent me to search for the meaning that Scientology at that time provided. So it's a lot about, as I quote from Samuel Beckett, who so famously said, fail again, fail better, it is that idea and that title, flunk period, start period, is a phrase that's used in Scientology when you're studying something and you don't do it right. It's not penalizing. Someone just says flunk, start, like do it again, do it better. And that just seemed like a really excellent title to do with start, let's start again and let's do this differently this time. Let's do it, you know, the way you want to do it, which is very much a theme of how you reclaim years that you feel that you've lost. The sales team at Counterpoint was a little iffy about that title, but my editor said, no, it's the perfect title. We all agreed it was. But it is true that flunk is a really powerful word. And I was at a reading one evening with about five other writers. We all had read from our works, and they were selling the books afterwards. And this was last November, and I remember a person was walking along with their hands over the titles, like which book were they going to pick up, and their hand hovered like a Geiger counter over my own, and their hand literally pulled back. I think the word flunk has such a powerful, powerful statement attached to it. So our hope with what we're doing with the paperback, and I'm just in love with the new cover, it's so gorgeous, is to name it simply the subtitle, which is Reclaiming My Decade Lost in Scientology. In many ways, hoping to continue to reach the people that it's already reaching, which is that group that, certainly the ones that are interested in anything to do with the Church of Scientology and the strange stuff that goes on inside of its inner workings, but also that idea of how do you reclaim part of a life that you feel you haven't. So I'm really honored that Counterpoint believes so deeply in the book, that because it's the sales have been great, is to give it this sort of life that with a new cover as well as a new title, to put it into the world to what we hope is even larger readership.
Well, and the other thing is that often I think readers or people in bookstores or online, they're shopping for books, they're not noticing the subtitle, so that you just see Flunk start and you go, oh, that's, I don't know what that is, and move on to the next one. Instead of
that's
actually, you know,
excellent,
reading it and reading the flap copy and, you know, the blurbs and all of that. Because I think at first when I saw it, I went, oh. And then I started reading it and I understood what Flunk Start meant. But, yeah, I mean, the subtitle is what got me.
Yes, I think that you've articulated that very well. The other sort of worry was that people were thinking of it as a self-help book. Rather than as a memoir, and that too seemed something that we could rectify with just moving the subtitle to a more prominent position.
Yeah,
I'm really pleased. It was a little startling, you can imagine, when I got that phone call, but since my editor, the wonderful Jennifer Alton, had been so supportive of Flunk Start in the first place when she called to say, well, we're thinking about this, I listened up because she's brilliant, and I just adore her, so...
I do love the graphic, though, on the cover. I think it's beautiful, the colors and the woman falling. I think it's great.
Yeah, I really love it, too. It's I like because of the fall of my brother and the sort of down the rabbit hole aspect of what it was to be pulled in as I was. I think it's really appropriate. But I'm really fond of the new cover too, which couldn't be more different. Yeah, it's currently up on Amazon, so interested listeners can take a look.
I was curious about the extensive bibliography and endnotes, and why you went to that extent.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate being able to address that. I'm one of those readers that loves endnotes, and I keep a bookmark there when I'm reading a book that has endnotes. I like to read them because often the author will give information in addition to bibliographic, you know, detail that isn't necessarily germane to the point they're making on that particular page or something. So there were two reasons. One was for that, to give extra information from time to time about things that just felt they'd be ancillary to what was the actual, you know, moment on that page. But also, there is a very, very powerful ethos at work within Scientology, which is that you never, ever tell somebody else what Scientology is about, that you always refer them to the bulletin or the policy letter or the words by L. Ron Hubbard that indicate, that will tell the reader for him, her, themselves what the thing is. So you're not interpreting. And this is a very powerful, powerful idea in the church. So I felt that it was very important, as I was indeed, even though I am simply talking about a very personal experience that happened for me, to me, as I went through my time connected to Scientology, that whenever I actually quoted or referred to these ideas, I would give the equivalent of Scientology's chapter and verse to make sure that any reader that was interested could go find, or that the church itself, were it tempted to come up against me in terms of copyright issues, could say, no, I have covered my bases absolutely, whether it's a website or a book. This is where you will find this information and can read it for yourself. Felt that was extremely important, and I'm very grateful that Counterpoint was so supportive, and you know, even the design team really got behind, so it looks really attractive on the page and is inviting, and I'm really pleased by that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I love endnotes too, and I think the entire book is wonderful. We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice or words of wisdom for the memoirist listening.
Well, I was intrigued what Liz Scott was saying about not using it as therapy. I think sometimes, and I know for myself that you do write often to sort out what you think about a thing. I certainly know I do, and I know a lot of writers do that. I do think there's something valuable about taking the time to process what that experience means to you. And one of the problems, of course, life keeps going on as you write a memoir, so you keep thinking, is it over now? Have I had my epiphany now? You know, it's like, is this the final epiphany? But I think that that's important. And I also think reading memoirs is so important. And I think really examining, this is sort of really talking completely as a writer to writers, but really looking at structure. I think that so many memoirists have really examined how they structure their stories. So how they get, you know, plot is not just what happens, but it's the order in which the reader discovers what happens. That's what keeps people turning a page of a story of any kind and any length. And that's something that I think someone working on a memoir could really examine. How do memoirists, where do they begin? How do they unfold? Where do they give particular important information? What keeps me turning the page? Because all of those things are just as important in memoir as they are in fiction or other kinds of writing.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me when I talk to somebody writing a memoir, and their first memoir, and they say they don't read memoirs, and I'm thinking, huh?
Yeah.
Or exactly, writing a novel, Barbara. Right? Or writing short stories, but they don't read much. I find that so fascinating. Why, you know, I don't know. There's so much to say about that. That should be a show unto itself at some point.
Yes, it's true.
I do want to thank you for taking the time and talking about Flunk Start, Reclaiming My Decade Lost in Scientology. Thank you, Sans.
Really honored to join the fantastic group of writers that have been on your show. Thank you so much, Barbara.
Oh, my pleasure. Again, that was Sans Hall. Her book is Flunk Start, Reclaiming My Decade Lost in Scientology. If you just tuned in and you want to hear the podcast when it is podcast, go to iTunes or Stitcher and subscribe to Writers on Writing so you will know when it's there. That's all the time we have today. I've been happy to be here with these memoirists. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Join us next week with more Writers on Writing. Thank you for being here.